My guest at this time is Joshua Charles. He is head of the Rediscovery Project at the Public Policy Institute of William Jessup University. He's co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Original Argument, along with Glenn Beck. Joshua's new book is Liberty's Secrets, The Lost Wisdom of America's Founders. And Joshua, thanks very much for being with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
What was the general motivation for this book? Is it that you believe America has largely forgotten why our nation was established the way it was, or that your research shed some more light onto how our founders were thinking as they crafted our government?
I'd say generally both. It's certainly true that our roots have largely been forgotten, and I would largely say by people of all political persuasions. One thing that you realize when you read the founders' writings for themselves, and they left us a lot, you know, newspaper editorials, diary entries, letters, even whole books in some cases, you find out how much we really don't know them very well. There's a ton of material there, which many on left and right, unfortunately, it's become just a Google it and get some quick quote, whether it's verified or not. And unfortunately, there's a lot of quotes that are taken utterly out of context and or they are spurious. They don't even exist. So they're just false quotes that have been misattributed for years, decades, sometimes for over 100 years, and they just go down as being from the founders. And so yes, I was concerned about reacquainting, you know, my fellow citizens with the original spring from which we came, as I put it in the introduction, but also because there's just a lot that we don't know about the founders that go beyond, you know, politics, but talk about morality and religion and education and finance and money and all that sort of stuff. And so they talk about a lot of things that I think are directly applicable to our political life as a nation, but which nonetheless are valuable, not because they're from the founders per se, but because they so convincingly talk about fundamental truths, fundamental realities that are just true in every time and every place, and which are good for wise people to be acquainted with.
You begin the thrust of your book by explaining how the founders understood human nature in a way that was different than governments before them, and how many people, even in our own country, look at it today. What did they grasp in terms of human nature that really dictated the way that they set up our government?
Well, most of human history has vacillated between two extremes. The extremes are either human nature is utterly flawed to the extent that it can do nothing good or rarely anything good, and the other, that human nature is essentially good on its own. It's just its environment that either, you know, that accentuates either its negativity or its, you know, the nature versus nurture debate. So, and this is actually, you know, the fundamental difference in much of our political debates these days, whether human nature is flawed or whether it's good. And so, you know, the American Revolution combined the truth that both propositions have, namely that human nature is very flawed. Human history provides plenty of examples of this. It's why they set up the different, you know, the three branches to control the accumulation of power to make sure it didn't end up in one person, one group, or anything like that. But at the same time, they knew that human nature was quite capable of doing great things. And so that's what it was, that sweet spot, that balance that they so clearly got, that yes, human nature is flawed. It is capable of horrific things, as history has shown many examples of before 1776 and plenty, probably more even afterward. But it's also capable of great things. And if it's confined, if it's directed in the proper channels, it can lead to far greater prosperity and far greater just well-being in general for everybody. And so it was, you know, beforehand, you know, you have the whole divine right of kings idea, the idea that people need to be ruled by monarchs who were, you know, set up by God. And so to rebel or to in any way controvert the monarch is to controvert God himself. You know, that was based on an overly pessimistic view of human nature. Whereas something like the French Revolution, they believed that, you know, basically heaven on earth was possible. But that led them into equally oppressive, in some ways more oppressive measures than absolute monarchs had, because they thought, well, you know, human nature is perfectible, and so we just need to wipe out the people whose human nature doesn't agree with our agenda. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, with the guillotine and the Reign of Terror and whatnot, and that's why France vacillated between, you know, anarchy and absolute rule for so many years after the French Revolution. So the founders hit the sweet spot.
You also talk about the difference in people's current understanding of liberty, both many people today saying simply it means that I get to do what I want versus the founders' idea of protecting and even expanding freedoms that they believe were ordained by God. So talk about the difference between the two and how we see it manifest right now.
Yeah, it actually hinges in many ways upon, you know, the famous phrase in the Declaration of Independence, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the key word being happiness. Happiness for the founders, and this was a long-standing definition going back literally thousands of years. You can find it in Greek philosophers, Roman philosophers, Christian thinkers, and theologians, you know, Thomas Aquinas and whatnot. And the definition of happiness has very much changed in the past, I don't know, I'd say 60 or so years, mostly post-World War II. But essentially, we view happiness today as self-fulfillment, the fulfillment of our desires. We oftentimes equate it with a good feeling, whether emotionally or whatnot. For the founders, however, the notion of happiness was the notion of the good life not being one of pleasure and hedonistic indulgence, per se. That could be part of it. They weren't anti-pleasure by any means. But at the same time, the good life was the virtuous life, the moral life. Cicero talks a lot about this. I quote him in the book, you know, the Roman statesman, almost 2,000 years before the founders. And so this was not a new idea that they came up with. It's really prevalent in the English tradition of ordered liberty from which the founders were inspired. It's prevalent in many streams of thought in Western culture. And so when Jefferson wrote The Pursuit of Happiness, he was talking about an innately ordered idea of liberty, that liberty is the moral pursuit of moral ends. And so the idea that you could have an immoral population or an unvirtuous population be free was a contradiction in terms, and which is why they so often repeated in so many ways and so many times throughout their entire lives that morality, particularly inspired by some sort of religious conviction, was absolutely necessary if a society was going to be free.
When talking about the preservation of a society, it's very interesting some of the things you quote from Alexis de Tocqueville about how a liberty-centered society could erode, and you list some of those principles that he suggested could be the downfall of our country, and you believe we've checked a lot of those off the list already.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they've been checked off the list so much as the trend lines are in place, so to speak. There's a absolutely amazing, you know, prophecy is what I call it, essentially Tocqueville's somewhat ominous and eerie prognostication about what tyranny in America could look like. Tocqueville was a great admirer of America, but, you know, most people don't know that he also had some pretty big worries about America and some big critiques. He was overall an admirer, there's no doubt. But his book, Democracy in America, is over 800 pages, at least in my version. And so most people don't take the time to read 800-page books anymore. So we've come up with this kind of stereotypical, cliched version of Tocqueville that is just not true. And so I include a pretty extensive quotation of his prophecy at the end of Democracy in America. And essentially it was all about the development of a narcissistic culture that was bent toward the pursuit of pleasure. There's other facets to it, but that's essentially it, where the individual becomes solely about themselves. The wonderful thing about the system devised by our founders is it provides for an immense amount of liberty. But that liberty cannot be fully actualized, so to speak, unless on an individual level there's a sense of an organic and naturally flowing commitment to society and to community. America has always been, largely focused on individual liberties. That's true. But it also had this communal component, which for Americans, fortunately, didn't require government to coerce them. They just did it themselves. There's a number of quotes I include there about Tocqueville where he talks about how if someone was in trouble in America, people would come from far and wide to help them out. They'd empty out their pockets and, And I still think we have some of this culture still there. I think Americans are still, at least relatively speaking in the world, still very generous. But I do think, I don't have any statistics, actually, to back this up. But I would suspect, from what I've read, historical observations over the years by well-reputed people, this culture has somewhat declined in our country. And so, therefore, something has to fill the void. And that's unfortunately become government in too many cases. So the idea that the founders were entirely focused on the individual, Tocqueville really belies this notion and talks about that in America there was this very organic sense of community, even wherever you went. And so when that changed, when the individual became totally consumed with just themselves, their rights, their pleasures, without any emphasis on responsibility, without any emphasis on the commensurate duties which those rights naturally confer on anybody who claims them, then ultimately he describes the government as filling the void and becoming like a shepherd of sheeple, basically. He doesn't use the term sheeple, of course, but that's very much what he's describing. There's a key line in there. He said, "How can those who have given up the habit of self-government effectively choose those who shall do it for them?" And it's a piercing question because it gets to the heart of the matter. And so that was the essence of that prophecy. There's a lot of other very, very fascinating things, but it kind of ominously ends with him saying that such a people, they're vacillating between different solutions. They're looking for solutions to the problems, and eventually they become tired of themselves and their constitution, which I think is extremely fascinating given the state of our society. So one would think that perhaps after listening to me say this, that I am pessimistic about America. In some ways I am. Short term I am. I do think, however, that history teaches that there's nothing that is inevitable. But it also shows that great nations, great peoples tend to follow similar sorts of trends when it comes to the degrading of their culture and the undermining of those national habits which gave rise to their flourishing in the first place. And so America really is no different in this respect. We've had a great run, and I think that run can still continue. I think our country has a lot of qualities, a lot of resources that if we got smart, we could really do amazing, amazing things, and we still got a lot of great things going for us. But that goes back to why I wrote this book. We're very unfamiliar with our own story. We're very unfamiliar with the men who, thought of this idea. John Adams called the vision of America, our virtuous vision of the kingdom of the just. I can hardly imagine anybody talking about America in such a way anymore. But I do think that if we regain this, if we teach it in our schools again, I really do think we can get back on track. I think it'll take a generation. I don't think this is win 2016, win 2017, everything will be okay. I think this is literally a project which, if it was embarked upon, would take probably to the end of my life, if not longer, to get us back on track. But I do think it's possible.
Real quick, just flesh that out a little bit more. Given the size of government, the attitude an increasing number of people in our country have about the role of government and what it should be doing for them, how do you roll this back?
Well, I honestly, this may sound somewhat cliche. I do think it starts at home. I think there's a tendency in human nature to think that if we just achieve this big outward visual, quote, solution that we can detect with our senses, that it is, it's a quick fix, or if we just elected the right person, the right president, I think that's part of it. But I think it really does begin at home, with parents really taking to heart, the education of their children, the education of the next generation, getting involved in community. There's a lot of different threads to it, to this answer. It's really difficult to answer very quickly, but I think, nourishing those habits in the home, in the community, are absolutely essential. I think we need to become a nation of readers again. I think reading is an essential habit, which Americans of past generations have engaged in quite voraciously, which we've largely given up. I'm also very concerned about the lack of dialogue in our culture. I'm definitely more conservative, socially and economically. But I'm very worried about much of the conservative movement today. I'm very worried about the left, too, but they're not my people. Conservatives are my people, and I'm very worried. There seems to be this infatuation with the latest conspiracy theories and we live in a big society, and we've got to govern ourselves with other people who have very different opinions than us. And we have to be able to talk with each other. It doesn't mean we have to agree. It doesn't mean we give up our principles. But I'm really, really concerned about the decline in civic dialogue, which is one of the reasons why I can't stand his opinions, but I actually really respect Bernie Sanders. And it's why I really like Ben Carson, because I don't agree with either of them, certainly not Bernie Sanders. But I don't agree with Carson absolutely everything. But I like the fact that he can get people who previously weren't at the table at the table. You know, when you see him at The View the other day, these ladies had really nothing to say to him because their ignorance was exposed for what it is. And he didn't do it by smashing them in the face with some rhetorical bombastic bomb. He just gently, kindly did it. And he lived out, you know, how a Christian should engage in dialogue. So there are all these various threads, but of those few, civic dialogue, I think that's absolutely essential, and the habits of heart and community in the home, in the church, in the school, re-engaging and becoming a nation of readers again. Those are just some of the threads, but those are some of the three that come to mind, you know, at the forefront of my mind at the moment.
Joshua, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much for being with us. Best of luck with
the book.
Thank
you, sir. Appreciate it.
Joshua Bye. Charles is the head of the Rediscovery Project at the Public Policy Institute of William Jessup University. He's the co-author, along with Glenn Beck, of the New York Times bestseller, The Original Argument. His new book is Liberty's Secrets, The Lost Wisdom of America's Founders. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.